Welcome to In The Frame, a series where we're touring the UK, meeting business leaders and taking a look at the big picture of what makes businesses tick. I'm Paul Kempster.
And I'm Andrea DeLay. And together we co-head the mid-corporate business for Barclays, as well as being co-hosts for this podcast series.
Hello, everyone, and I'm delighted to be recording the latest of our In The Frame podcasts in glorious Southwest England, which is actually home to me. And I'm in one of the most fascinating of places today, Bodmin Jail in Cornwall, which, as you'll hear a little bit later, is a unique hotel and visitor centre. So you're probably going to hear a few background noises of a real hotel in action. And believe it or not, the beast of Bodmin Moor is underneath me in the visitor centre. So you may hear a little bit of growling as well. I'm delighted to be joined by Rob Cox, who's the CEO of the Tudor Hotels Collection, and Chris Head, who is one of Barclays' mid-corporate industry heads. So, Rob, thank you for joining us today, and you better explain why we are in jail today, and perhaps you can kick us off by telling us about the big picture of your business.
Morning, Paul. Thanks for coming. It's great that you've made the journey. We're blessed to have Bodmin Jail as one of our properties. Tudor Hotels Collection exists as a development company, essentially born from the idea of taking heritage assets like this beautiful jail and creating hotels or visitor attractions. And so you're in our landmark project, the first one we finished, Bodmin Jail Hotel.
Fantastic. And I have to say, having toured the jail and the visitor centre this morning, firstly, I'll certainly be coming back to the visitor centre, and I'll certainly be coming back to the hotel with my wife because she would love it here. But you talk about choosing heritage sites, and I know that you've got three or four things on the go in the overall collection. Perhaps just tell us a little bit more about the story behind why you've chosen those particular sites.
Sure. So like many businesses, it's a very organic journey, and it starts with our chairman, Timo, who was on holiday with his family, coming down to Cornwall, stumbling across this jail, which was derelict at the time. It had a small visitor attraction operating out of this building that we're sitting in now, and he fell in love with it. And he imagined that one day he could make it into something incredible and set about putting together a team to do exactly that. And that's how I got involved. I was part of that team, luckily for me, sent down from London to help develop this beautiful building into a hotel. From that small start, 4 years later, we managed to finally open what is now the Bodmin Jail Hotel, £65 million worth of effort and blood, sweat and tears from 150-odd people that helped to build it. And we have premier visitor attraction, a 4- or 5-star hotel operating here. But the cornerstone of what we do is a passion for the history and a passion for telling stories and bringing something to life for people and giving them more than just a stay in a hotel or a visit to attraction, giving them something which is an experience which can be educational, emotional, will stay with them for life. So we've chosen to continue that journey, and we've acquired 2 further sites, the Redcliffe Hotel in Torbay in Paignton and Kent Cavern in Torquay, which I know you know well, which is a 2-million-year-old set of caves. So we have a diverse portfolio, but all centered around the idea of bringing history to life and giving people a very high quality experience of what was available 200 years ago or 2 million years ago, depending on which site you're at.
That certainly is a diverse collection. It's the most unique operation I've seen, actually. How do you go about searching or coming across these types of unique assets that have got that opportunity, I guess, to put your vision around them and develop them out?
I think with any business, you have to have a very solid vision, a solid foundation to what you're trying to do. So we stay truthful to our values, luxury, history in England, a sense of place, and trying to find things that fit in with that. Actually, it's not that difficult. The country is blessed with an amazing history and some amazing, unique sites. And, you know, everybody here and everybody listening will know of a place that they think should be rebuilt or reclaimed or redeveloped. And we're blessed in a way, and we see it as a mission to bring some of these places back to the public use for educational purposes, for people to stay in, to enjoy. And we do it because it's sustainable. We feel the right thing to do.
I think coming back to the jail here and the hotel here today that we're in, my own observations coming in is that eclectic mix, really, today of your guests and your visitors? Everything from families walking around the visitor center and the immersion experience to adults enjoying the unique luxury stay in the hotel. There's something for everyone, I guess, isn't there, in fusing that together?
Yes, yeah, certainly. And you know, that's one of the things we like most about the opportunity to take school groups, but also right through to PhD level. And we've got PhD students that work for us that are doing intense qualifications over at Kent's Cavern here as well. Really, really experts in their fields, and they're able to look at our places as a model for what they're doing. But also you have general public that just are looking for an afternoon to escape the rain on their half-term break, or you have heritage groups that travel the world looking for these sorts of sites. So it is really, really diverse. I think what I love most about hospitality and hotels is the fact that they are open and welcoming places, and you don't finish your project and then close it to most people. You actually finish your project and then open it to the world. And the feedback you get and the smiles that you get when people first walk into the atrium, as you did earlier, or into Redcliffe, it's incredible. And that's what makes it worth doing.
Well, that's actually a great segue, really, because I was going to ask you to cast your mind back to, as you say, many years, blood, sweat and tears, a lot of money to develop this really unique asset that we're in today. But if you think back to what your goals were, the objectives, have they been met in the first period of trading?
It's a really interesting question, because when you set out on a project like this, the goal, first and foremost, is really, it's a voyage of discovery. You know, can it be done? Is it even possible to take a prison building that's been derelict for 120 years with no roof and turn it into a hotel? And you get structural engineers to come along and tell you that, yeah, it's just about possible if you do it correctly. And you get all of these other consultants to come along and help you. And the challenge for the first 2 or 3 years is really, can we get this done in a sensible time scale before the money runs out? And that absorbs you. We then got to the point where obviously we could get it done. We think we did a fairly nice job of it, but then it comes to operation. And actually, the building project stops and you get into the real world of inviting people in, running restaurants, running hotels, changing beds, making beds. And it's a whole nother project. So the question was, the objective met? The objective's never met. The objective is to give people an amazing experience every day. And we can make that experience better every day. Creating teams that want to provide people with amazing experiences is the objective. Yeah, we do that for sure. It will never be complete.
How have you found that shift personally, Rob? Because your background prior to Tudor was very much development. And then you've continued that through for 3 or 4 years with the jail here and everything else you've been doing with Kent and Redcliffe. But now you've got a lot more focus on the operational side of things. So how have you found that personally?
I was always interested in hotels. And, you know, right back, my first job in project management was at a hotel in Paddington, the Great Western at Paddington. And I've always loved the hospitality side of construction. So I've always stayed in the hotels part of it, but never directly involved in operations. And I never really expected to be either, to be honest. But I've got to say, the last 3 or 4 years, getting into the nuts and bolts of how these different businesses work and how you interact with customers that aren't just a customer for a construction project, it's incredible. And as we were saying this morning at breakfast, Chris, I can no longer have a stay in a hotel and enjoy it, because I'm looking at all these small elements of the operation, which are incredible. And, you know, even going out for dinner with my wife, she hates it because I'm always looking at how we can operate better and copy things that other people are doing. And I think if you're business minded, whatever you do, you look at it in the same way. You break it down to its component pieces and you try to make each one of them perfect, whether that's building a building or building a hospitality business.
I think that's a really good question, actually, Chris. And we think about this in our own business, don't we? And what I'm hearing really from Rob is that focus on consistently excellent all the time. You know, it's you can't never let it sleep, can you? You've got to stay on top of these things to achieve that ongoing standard that you have the vision for.
I think so. And I think we passionately believe that quality is really the only real commodity. You can sell things at a lower price. You can sell things at more of the same thing, but actually quality is the real commodity. And if you can give people a quality experience, then actually you've got the competitive advantage. So our hunt whatever we're doing, our hunt is to find the best quality products, the best quality service, and provide it to people, whether they're visiting our museums and attractions or whether they're staying the night in the hotel.
I'd love to, in a moment, maybe come back to your future projects in a little bit more, and particularly build on this theme of how, as Chris says, how you've kind of gone about spinning plates and balancing development versus operating. And there's no hard line, is there? You know, the two things blend. But just wanted to take you back, if I could, Rob, to you mentioned that there were times during the development, the few years, where you kept asking yourselves as a management team, could this be done in time, in budget? I'm imagining there would be some fairly sweaty moments that you would have gone through. What would be your reflection on that? And how's it galvanized you for the future? But maybe also by extension, what tips would you give other business entrepreneurs that are taking on bold challenges?
For me, it's not really about anticipating the challenges, because in heritage assets, you can't do that. You don't know what you're going to find. It's a discovery. And you can plan as best you can, but you will never know until you're there on the coalface with the drill in your hand, finding out what's behind that wall. So I think, like any business, you have to be able to adapt in the moment, and you have to be able to adapt with your overall vision in mind. So as long as you hold that vision strongly in your mind and you know quality is your guiding light, you definitely want to achieve a high level of quality. Actually, you just have to be adaptable. And you have to accept that sometimes things don't work out exactly as you expected. And what I found amazing here was the ingenuity of the teams that we had around us, the ability to think on their feet, change their direction at a moment's notice, and find a solution to something which looks like a problem on the face of it. And this building, and you know, all of our buildings, but this one especially, stands testament to people's ability to adapt in the moment. And that's what I like about heritage projects. They're fun, they're exciting, and every day's a different challenge.
Yeah, it must be very rewarding to see what you achieve at the end of all that hard work and
imagination. Rewarding, yes. Frustrating as well, because you always feel like you could have improved it or there was something else you could have done. But they're living things, and buildings don't stay the way you built them. They change over time, and they adapt, and they move. And we have a million plans for this building. You know, even though it's, in inverted commas, finished, it will never be finished. We want to adapt it and grow it and make it better.
So coming back then to some of your other projects that you've got on the go, and again, sort of this blend of development versus operating. So we're going to leap from this building's, what, 200-300 years old in Cornwall. So we're now going to leap into Devon. Okay, and so 2 million years old, yeah. The caves.
Turn your stone upside down and move to Devon.
Which I know you're, you know, relatively recently acquired in this sort of the group's history. But you talked earlier to Chris and I as we were wandering around about some of the plans for an educational centre. So heritage with education, perhaps just expand on that a little bit and, you know, how you see that panning out.
I mean, we're very lucky to be in a position where we can bring our products to the youngest members of our society and embed our amazing places in their minds very early on. We have Kent's Cavern 2 school tours every day in term time. So groups of children coming to learn about it on the curriculum, which is fantastic. What we would like to do there is make that a center for Stone Age learning, because I believe there are huge gaps in people's knowledge of UK history and world history. And it would be nice to think that we could play a small part in helping to fill that. And the caverns, as they were excavated and as they still are being excavated and looked at today, unleash a mine of interesting information every day. So we're finding new DNA samples of different species. We're finding collections of bones and skeletal remains from different types of humans. And you can start to tell stories around people that didn't live 200 years ago, like in this building, but actually 40,000 years ago, which is an incredible thing to start to piece that together and share it. So we hope to make this Centre for Stone Age Learning in Devon at Kent's Cavern. We think it's a project worth following up on. We want to make it a visitor attraction, which will encourage people to enjoy themselves and have a lot of fun, but also learn as much as they can whilst they're there. That's really what drives us, is this idea of sharing education and entertainment at the same time. We're not going to try and make any stupid phrases with those two words, but you know, this idea of harmoniously blending actually learning and enjoyment is a great plan for us.
We were talking last night, Rob, about the dust sample. I mean, how many animals were found in such a small sample of dust?
Yeah, it's incredible. One of the archaeologists that was working on site had a meeting with us the other day, and he said, yeah, I kept some of that dust that we were looking at last time, and we can analyze its DNA now, and we'll look at the structures in it. And he's found hundreds of different types of DNA within the dust of different animals and everything else. So he's coming back to do a real project on that this year, and we'll start to analyze samples of dust to see how many species of animal and human live together at the same time. So, you know, you're talking about things that we would know as a saber-toothed tiger or a woolly mammoth or a woolly rhino or something like that, living at the same sort of time as potential human species, which you don't necessarily think about now. It's incredible stuff. And there is so much to learn from history, and we want to play a small part in unlocking that.
I think it's a fascinating business vision to have, taking heritage assets and then breathing life into them and opening them up to a new audience in the way you're describing. And of course, I'm completely biased, as you know, because I live in Torbay. So you have my full backing. So please do invest. I think that would be great for the area.
It is great for the area. And we've had a huge amount of support in the Bay from lots of people around, because they recognize that they have something which is unique, and we're custodians of it at the moment. We won't be forever. It will be there long after we've gone. So we just try and play our part whilst we're here.
No, that's fantastic. So I'm going to switch back a little bit to your high standards for guests, visitors, members of the public come and experience the collection. And maybe just tell us a little bit more about the 666 menu, which I think is new.
So our executive head chef, Dane, is looking at the moment to try to piece together all of the strands that we already have, which really plays to our localism agenda. We use local butchers, local suppliers for everything that we possibly can. And Dane wants to take that one step further. So we have some fields just to the north of where we're sitting now. And Dane has a vision of putting some greenhouses in there, creating some areas to grow goodness knows what, which is going to put on the menu some crops, some interesting stuff, I'm sure. And we'll call it the 666 menu, which is 666 yards from his kitchen. Yeah, it just works out. That's the distance to the center of the field from the kitchen. We're really looking forward to that project this year. We'll be looking to talk to the AA and to Michelin about green awards that we can enter with that product as well. And also just to offer the clients of the hotel something slightly different, something they wouldn't get necessarily anywhere else.
It conjured up images in my mind of when you have these fields, you're going to put up some signs, are you, to say, please don't steal the wheat and things like that. Because we saw on the visitor center that people 200 years ago met a grisly end if they were to steal wheat.
I think it's warning enough, isn't it?
I think it is.
One of the amazing things about the countryside and being in Cornwall, even though we're in a town here, is the fields aren't far away. And I think people's understanding of where food comes from and the part that the supply chain plays in business is growing every day. And I think our customers are much more sensitive to where we're getting our produce and how we are preparing our menus. So it's something we work really hard on.
I think that's absolutely right. And we see across many industries that we're privileged to look after as a banking team, the importance of sustainability really is flowing down to granular level now and people making decisions.
The Purple Pound explores the spending power of disabled people. Being as accessible and inclusive as possible means your business will be better placed to unlock the value of the Purple Pound. From accessible toilets and parking to adjustable lighting, ramps and seating, find out how your business can provide an inclusive customer experience. Go to barclayscorporate.com and search Unlocking the Power of the Purple Pound to read our full insights.
I believe you've got some plans here for an eco spa, and you know, I think that might have some environmental considerations around it. Maybe tell us a bit more about that.
Well, Bodmin Jail actually as a product is incredibly sustainable. And I think that's one of the, maybe not a misconception, but a misunderstanding of sustainability. Sometimes you operate in these older buildings and people think that's impossible to make that sustainable and efficient, but quite the opposite. Already by not knocking down and rebuilding this building, we've saved something like 30,000 cubic tons of CO2 from just not doing it. So we start with an advantage. When you factor in meter thick walls, new double glazing, heat recovery systems, energy efficient systems that you can put in, we actually have very efficient buildings. So putting the spa onto this building, again, using heat recovery, using the pool potentially to take waste heat from the building, it just adds to that overall effect. And one thing our engineers, Harrop, were very good at was designing a building which was actually efficient in use. And we've been pleasantly surprised actually at how sustainable this building has been. And our plans for Redcliffe as a result have changed to make that as sustainable as possible as well. We've looked at seawater cooling, geothermal, lots of different solutions for that building as well. So we passionately believe that you can do heritage in a very, very sustainable, carbon neutral way, right down to our battery powered cars and charging points in each of our hotels.
And that's really fascinating, because I think many people wouldn't realize how sustainable a 200 odd year old prison can be. And then a hotel, so for those listening, the Redcliffe is a hotel which literally abuts the sea, doesn't it? The sea crashes into the basement of it, essentially.
Yeah. Has a tunnel leading onto the beach, yeah.
Was it a smuggler's tunnel by any chance or not?
Most likely at some point. It was actually purpose-built by a chap as his home. So he built it so that his wife could go to the beach in private.
Oh, very nice too. Good. I'm going to change tack slightly and just, if I may, get a bit of insight from you about the challenges of staff. Hiring, recruiting, retaining the right quality of staff. Clearly in an operating business, that's essential. Obviously in a development phase, that's also essential. And Chris, I'll bring you in a moment as well, if you wouldn't mind, because get your perspective. You speak to a lot of clients, and I know that we've heard lots from businesses for the last few years around the big challenge of staff recruitment and staff retention. How have you found that here? And is that a challenge for you? Is it getting easier?
It's absolutely a challenge. In fact, I would say it's probably our number one challenge, is to build teams of people who share our vision, share our passion, because ultimately what we are giving to our clients and our guests is an experience, and that experience is led by our teams. So creating teams who are so passionate about their product, so passionate about giving people a good day, giving people a nice holiday, giving people a great experience, educating people, it's hard work to keep that level of energy in your team and to find people who can sustain it. Hospitality is a very, very difficult industry to operate in. So yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard to maintain the levels you need. Unfortunately, as a country, we've underinvested in education around hospitality. All of the good hospitality schools predominantly sit on the continent. And, you know, we have some which are building up now in the UK and some are coming through really well, but we're behind the curve. And ultimately, people of my generation didn't aspire to work in hospitality. They aspired to work in other sectors, in banking or medical sector or some other sector. So we do have that struggle every day. But I don't think it's probably any different to any other industry that you would talk to or any other businessman that you would talk to. I think generally finding people to operate in any business is difficult. And you just have to be adaptable, as we've said, create methods where people can be comfortable coming to work, they can enjoy coming to work, you can make it somehow more appealing than the next place which they might go to work. And that's not always paying the most. Sometimes that's just giving interesting incentives or trying to create an ethos or an atmosphere where people enjoy being with their friends and colleagues. So nobody gets that 100% right. We're not perfect, but we try really hard. The week before, in fact, we took the whole team around all of the sites. We shut the sites down and we took the team, 110 of us went from one site to the other, and we had some events and we had a bit of a party at the end. And it was lovely to see everybody smiling and getting to enjoy what the guests get to see and getting to see each other's part of the business. So there are some definite benefits to being in hospitality, and we just have to bring them through and show more and more people that it's a great place to come and work.
Well, I was going to ask, what sort of tips would you give generally to any other business around, you know, staff retention, motivation, purpose, passion? But I think you've just given a really good example there recently of immersing all the staff in all of the assets and experiences if they were the client. That's a really nice touch.
Yeah. And it comes back again to quality. embedding in your team service quality, service excellence, and this sense of trying to each day do better than yesterday, rather than it becoming repetitive. It's actually a cliched thing to say, but it's a journey. You're actually trying to make the whole thing better every day and get everybody to engage in that together. That's the trick. So we are blessed with plenty of collateral, plenty of things to get our minds around, plenty of exciting projects. And I have such amazing people. I have people in the food and beverage department that will come to me with ideas for interior design. I have people in the development side of the business that will come to me with ideas for food and beverage. And it's lovely because everybody can engage with the hotel. Everybody has been a customer at a visitor attraction or a hotel or a restaurant. So it's nice. We get to share our ideas.
I think something I've seen and something that I know you do particularly well is selling that career progression within the company. So it's not come and work behind the bar. It's actually see the journey, see where you can get to. You have a number of other sites that they can move around to if need be, but it's around that journey that they can go on within the business.
I think creating a genuine meritocracy where people understand that actually it's what you do, it's how you behave that counts, not who you are, not where you came from, not what education you have. And promoting people on the basis of their passion, their enthusiasm, their skill. Some of our general managers started as heritage guides or in other parts of the business. Our general manager at Redcliffe started in the spa side of the business and moved up to general manager. Jess here at the jail was one of the heritage guides. So recognizing people for their passion, for their enthusiasm, for their talent, rather than their qualifications, I think is really, really important. Creating a real meritocracy provides people the confidence to go and express themselves.
I think that's a fantastic tip and guide, actually, for anybody trying to create that embedded success, because it is the people, as you say, that essentially run the business. They are the experience. Chris, just coming back to you, what are you hearing now from your clients around staff recruitment retention? Any general themes, anything that's easing or not?
Certainly an easing. I think coming out of the pandemic, that was probably our hottest topic in terms of finding good quality staff. I don't think there was a lack of supply of people, but finding good quality people with the sort of thing that Rob talks about, a real passion for the industry. I think we found that really tough. I think over the last 6 months or so, I've certainly felt that ease. I think the power has shifted towards the employee, and I think they're demanding more from the employer. And I think employers have woken up to that fact. And some of the things that Rob touches on, away days or loyalty sort of things that you can create with people, I think that is, we're seeing a lot more of that. And that's helped with retention. It's helped with attraction. So certainly an easing over the last 6 months or so.
I think there's a turning point where people off the back of COVID who spend a lot of time at home realized that actually this idea that they'd been propagated for years and years about finding a work-life balance probably doesn't exist. And actually what you need to find is a work-life harmony where actually your work life and your day-to-day social life is harmonious, and you can actually create, without counting the hours or counting the minutes, create this sense of harmony between going to work and being at home with your family. And in small ways, we try to help with that. And going forwards, that will be really when we know we've created success, is when everybody feels that harmony. Coming to work is not any longer something distinct from their time when they're having fun or enjoying it, but actually it's completely integrated with the rest of their time.
That's very, very wise words. Very wise. Now, I'm sensing you're a man for many projects, and I think one project I picked up in the future is possibly you're going to set up a UK hospitality school. So we'll leave you to think about that one for the future. But we've just mentioned there the P word, the pandemic, which of course was a big lesson for all businesses really to navigate. I think I'm right in saying that when the lockdown happened, the first lockdown happened, you were kind of mid-development, mid-build.
We were, yeah.
So my question is, how on earth did you cope with that?
It was a difficult time, clearly, for everybody, and no less here. One of the, I guess, benefits at that point of working in a fairly isolated location was that we were able to carry on with construction. The site, as you've seen now, is a big one, and we were able to create these pockets for people to work in well-segregated open-air areas. So we were able to continue with some works. It delayed us for sure, but actually it also served to allow us to do some more investigation work and to find better solutions to some of our problems. We've always tried to be adaptable. We were adaptable to the pandemic. It didn't really slow us down, didn't really cause us any harm, but the delays were unfortunately inevitable. We weren't able to open until May 21. We could have opened probably 6 months earlier. So one slight delay, but compared to some of the trials and tribulations other people were going through, it didn't harm us too much.
Thanks, Rob. And it's interesting to hear how, you know, the team managed through that lockdown and pandemic initially. And as you say, you know, many challenges come to many businesses. And since May 2021, of course, we've seen other challenges come through, haven't we? Supply chain challenges and political unrest and everything else. I guess what's interesting, though, is to get your perspective on, you never know what's coming, do you, in business? I want to tease out in a moment a little bit about the importance of external team support as well. So you've been well supported in the developments. You talked about some of the professional support there as well. What's your sort of perspective on taking outside advice, whether it's banking, accounting, property, whatever it may be?
Yes, it's a really interesting question. I mean, Barclays' relationship is great, and personally, I've banked with Barclays forever. And when we bought the Redcliffe, you held the account for Redcliffe, so it was a natural transition. Darren and Chris and the team were so helpful bringing us on board with the rest of it and then dealing with some loans and other bits and pieces. It's been a really good relationship so far, and having the opportunity to pick up the phone or drop an email to responsive people actually is, you know, everything for business. Response time is everything in whatever you do. So that's been really good. In the wider world, in terms of consultancy businesses, as a 25-year project manager working in a big consultancy business in London, I have to say I use consultants sparingly, and I rely on people that I can trust. We've built up relationships over the years with some fantastic businesses. Our architects here for the jail, 12 architects and Matt Cartwright, and we've taken them across to help us with Redcliffe as well, and they will help us with all our projects. So we have a great set of people and relationships which we've built up. But again, it always comes down to the individual. And coming back to what we were talking about before, it's about finding the people with the passion and the enthusiasm to come and support you on your journey, much more than their qualifications or what projects they've done in the past. So building teams, whether it be in-house or external, all comes down to the same thing. It's just finding the right people.
Yeah, I think that's great to hear. And I can see Chris is really delighted and relieved with your feedback. But I think the core message I guess I'm hearing is the importance of building a trusted team, whether it's in-house or broader than that, that can take you through business cycles, whether it's development or operating, you know, share the same passions, share the same vision.
Yes, and also the will and the desire to get things done. So one of my personal sort of drivers is just to get things done every day. And finding people that are like-minded, that aren't just in it for the end of the month and the next paycheck, but actually want to make a difference today. That's what we're all about. And we have those teams, luckily.
Rob, we were chatting a little bit earlier this morning around the pricing model that you've got here and seeking a bit of simplicity when it comes to that. But one thing that you were talking about was the changing consumer behaviours and the strive for better quality service as opposed to being price sensitive.
Yeah. And we noticed that, I think, any time when you get into quasi-recessionary period where times are tight and people are struggling with their day-to-day finances, you get two things evolve. There are those that need to go and save money and stop spending, and you get those that are only going to spend on high quality, good value stuff, and they've still got money to spend. And I guess our customer base is really split across those. Visitor attractions and hotels. Our cost model for the hotel is unashamedly based on the price of our goods and our services, which clearly in this day and age are not cheap. And reflecting the quality of everything we do in that pricing model, which ultimately the customer will choose whether they want to pay that price or not to stay in this incredible heritage building. And our USP is exactly what we've built here. You know, it's a different place to stay. It's a completely different experience, but it always comes back to quality. So we think pricing has moved now very much, and we don't try to be competitive on price. We try to be competitive on quality. If we can give people the best possible experience, we believe they'll pay handsomely for it.
You talked a little bit about the existing projects that you have and some of the things that are coming up, I guess, in the nearish future. But any dream locations that you would personally, putting aside economics for a moment, you know, go into the world of a blue sky, any dream locations that you'd love to take on?
I don't think they'll let us build a hotel next to Stonehenge, but that would be quite good fun. For us, it's much more about the history and what's actually around and about. So we look for locations where we can tell stories, where we can immerse ourselves in the heritage, the culture and the location. So no is the honest answer. There's no dream locations, but there are so many interesting properties in the UK, so many interesting heritage properties, and they crop up far too often. There are lots of challenging businesses out there and businesses that are suffering, and we see them quite often. I wouldn't mind a golf course next.
Sounds like fun.
But that might be a personal thing.
Yeah. Why not? So it's great to hear about your personal dream acquisition, Rob. And I fully endorse that, by the way. So look forward to hopefully playing golf with you one day there. I just wanted to ask you a few things. So what advice would you give your younger self when you reflect back?
Such a great question. And I think all the great answers are probably already taken. My younger self probably wouldn't have listened anyway. But I guess the learning really is to be confident and to go with your gut and to really rely on your instincts a lot more than you expect. Nobody has the right answers in business. A lot of people think they do, but actually it comes back to this theme of adaptability and being able to think quickly and move quickly and create great teams around you. So I think I was probably more confident in my younger days. And in some ways, I would like my younger self to come back and tell me now what I should do, because that young sort of slight aggression and confidence, I think, is a fantastic thing in business. And I would urge younger people to become entrepreneurs and to try things and to experiment with things, because there really is nothing to lose. But most of all, you should do things that you're interested in and create an environment, as I said before, which is harmonious and where you are passionate about what you do and time at work doesn't feel like it's detracting. A long answer to a short question.
No, I think it's a great answer, actually. It's great advice, isn't it? You know, be bold, I think, is the message, because it's only when you try things that you get different outcomes and unique assets like this. And I guess, you know, just reflecting back again, you've had a remarkable journey from a consultant into the CEO of a unique collection of hospitality assets. If you were starting out again, would you have taken a different route?
No. I mean, where I am now and everywhere I've been before has been part of a magnificent journey. And I'm eternally grateful to lots of people that have helped me along the way, from mentors that I've had over the years that have helped me immensely, you know, right through from my first days. So I look back with nothing but pride at what I've achieved. But actually, I spend most of my time looking at what's next and thinking about what we can do to make the business bigger and better and how we can make it perfect for our guests and our customers.
That's great advice. Thank you, Rob. And I just want to say a massive thank you to you for your time today and to Chris also for joining us. I mean, it's been a really enjoyable discussion for me, an even more enjoyable visit around the jail. Never thought I'd go to jail, but anyway, I've achieved it today. Thank you very much for your time today, gents.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow us to receive notifications of new episodes as they go live. For more insights or to find out how we can support your business, go to barclayscorporate.com. Copyright Barclays Corporate Banking, all rights reserved. Terms and conditions available at barclayscorporate.com.